The novel coronavirus has come to Southern California. This week, Los Angeles County and other counties have declared public health emergencies. So have several cities. That means they can all work together. Public health laboratories have increased their capacity for testing, and officials are warning us all not to underestimate the possible danger. There will be regular radio updates and guidelines, some of which are already familiar. Wash your hands, try not to touch your face, and don't hug. Ask, how you doing? In a moment, we'll talk with a longtime advisor to the World Health Organization about what is known and what is not known about the COVID-19 pandemic. First, the economy. Mark Zandi is chief economist at Moody's Analytics. Always good to have you with us.
Thank you, Warren.
How vulnerable is the economy?
It's vulnerable. If the virus spreads as the CDC is anticipating, it'll be highly disruptive. We'll get some schools closings, child care centers, businesses in different communities across the country. And if China is a case study, probably is a pretty good one, that's going to be quite disruptive to the economy. So the economy is going to struggle here through the first half of the year.
How's Wall Street doing?
Well, Wall Street's trying to digest it all. They took a big step down last week as I think investors marked up their expectations that the economy is going to have a problem, perhaps even a recession. I don't think investors have fully discounted a recession, though, not quite yet. They're not there yet. I think they're going to wait and see exactly how this virus spreads and, you know, what kind of damage it does.
Did they start out by underestimating it? Have they come around?
Well, at first they completely ignored it. It really wasn't on anybody's radar screen. But I think the thing that put it on people's screen was when the virus clearly jumped outside of China. It showed up in Italy and Korea a little over a week ago. That caused people to take notice. And then, of course, the CDC came out and said, well, this looks like it's going to be a pandemic, meaning it's going to be everywhere, and it's going to come here and engulf us as well. And I think that's when investors took notice.
Given what you just suggested about schools and childcare and businesses, what's the impact on working people?
It's, you know, tough, obviously. Obviously, we're all going to be dealing with the potential of being ill or being ill, and then or our loved ones or our friends or neighbors. So that's going to be pretty trying. And then if schools close, daycare centers close, then obviously parents can't go to work. They have to stay home. And many people, if they don't go to work, they don't get paid. And many of these households are living paycheck to paycheck. So this is going to be a problem pretty quickly.
What about conferences and that sort of thing? Big gatherings.
Yeah, that's already shutting down. So travel is being significantly affected. Business travel, major corporations are now limiting the ability of their employees to go to travel. Conferences are being canceled. So events, the health experts are telling us that we should avoid large gatherings. And, I think corporate America is taking that to heart and is limiting the large gatherings they're going to participate in. So travel has been significantly disrupted. And of course, tourism has been affected quite significantly. Cruise ships and the airlines and tourist destinations all being impacted quite significantly.
What about the airlines? They, as I understand it, are beginning to cancel flights.
They are. At first it was flights to China, and then as the virus has spread across the globe, airlines everywhere are now canceling flights. Domestic travel, not a problem yet, but international travel, that's a bigger deal. And driving all this most obviously is that people just now realize it's probably not a good idea to travel overseas, at least not now. You might get stuck overseas, and if you get sick, you want to be home, you don't want to be away. So the airlines are starting to cancel flights because they just don't have passengers.
You're in touch, of course, with the economy. That's why we have you on. What about the Federal Reserve? And is it really able to do anything when it lowers interest rates?
Well, it helps. Lower rates help buoy stock prices. We saw that. I mean, the Fed chair came out last Friday when the stock market was down 1,200 points. And when he basically told everyone he's going to cut rates, the market stabilized, and it's stabilized ever since. They cut rates this week. That's helped. So that's helpful. The lower rates makes it easier for businesses that need to finance their operations near-term, borrow at a lower rate. It helps the housing market. Mortgage rates are at record low. So I would, anyone with a mortgage, probably a good time to go up online and see if you can get a refinancing that would lower your monthly mortgage payment. So it helps. But you're making a good point, and that is there's limits to what the Fed can do. Now the federal funds rate target, the key interest rate the Fed controls, is at 1%. So there isn't much room between 1 and 0. So not a lot of room here to maneuver.
World trade?
International trade is being significantly affected. Obviously, the countries that are being disrupted, trade with those countries is way down. China, good case in point, second largest economy on the planet, biggest manufacturer on the planet, does a lot of trade. The global supply chain, a lot of it ends up in China. So our exports to China are being affected. Our imports from China are being affected because they're just not producing things there. Things are starting to come back to life a little bit in China, but it's not like it's coming roaring back, which, may be a good lesson for us that, this isn't going to be V-shaped. It's not like we're going to go down and come right back up. We're going to, things are going to be difficult, and it's going to take us a while to get going again. And so that's affected trade. And as different parts of the world get affected by this, I suspect we're going to see exports, imports, trade be affected more broadly. We obviously live in a very globalized economy, and when the global economy has a problem, we're affected by it.
Here's a question that I think every listener has been waiting for me to ask, and that is, what about the Trump administration?
Well, time to step up. Really think about this. If the Fed doesn't have room to maneuver, that means the onus is now switching to policy, fiscal policymakers. That's the Trump administration and Congress. And they really need to start thinking about fiscal stimulus. This is a temporary deficit finance, tax cuts, government spending increases to help support the economy. It works when you're in recession. If you go back to the financial crisis back a little over a decade ago, we had this huge stimulus called the Recovery Act, and it was very helpful. It was passed in February of 2009, and the economy was out of recession by June of 2009, in large part because of that stimulus. And that's it. It's things like payroll tax holiday, which would be very helpful to lower middle-income working households, more food stamps, more unemployment insurance benefits, because if people become unemployed, they're obviously going to be in a lot of financial stress. So there's a number of tried-and-true stimulus measures, but obviously the politics could be very difficult. We're in a presidential election year. Hopefully our lawmakers can get it together.
Tax cuts and spending increases in the midst of a very contentious election year. What are the chances they're going to work things out?
I'm hopeful. I think when push comes to shove, we will come together and we will do the right thing. We always do. We have historically. Might take a little longer to get it together and come together this go around, just given the circumstances, how partisan things are, and the fact this is a presidential election year. But at the end of the day, this is why we have government. This is what they're here for, for crises. I mean, it's the number one thing government's all about, and they need to step up, and I'm hopeful they will.
Thanks for making the most important call of all. Mark Zandi, Chief Economist at Moody's Analytics. Always good to have you.
Thank you so much.
As we speak, it's being reported that there has been bipartisan progress in the House and the Senate on a new spending program of some $8 billion. Now, as promised, a highly qualified expert on global public health. Lawrence Gostin is professor of medicine at Georgetown University. He's director of the Collaborating Center on National and Global Health Law at the World Health Organization. He advises the WHO on pandemic preparedness. He served on two global commissions assessing the Ebola outbreak in West Africa in 2015. Professor, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Warren. I appreciate it.
Let me ask you the broadest and most general question I can think of, and it's this. What do we know? What do we need to know about COVID-19?
Okay, well, what we know so far is that... it's highly transmissible. If you think about somebody with an influenza, for example, it's at least as contagious as influenza, probably more contagious. So we're likely to see, large numbers of cases and very rapid spread. Just think about flu and all. You can't stop it. It just circumnavigates the globe. COVID-19 is starting to look like that. At the moment, the death rate, that is the number of people who die per case, is considerably greater than flu. And so I think the idea that we've been told, well, it's just the, you know, sniffles or the cold or the flu, really understates it. And so it's, at the moment, it looks like it's around 10 to 20 times more deadly than the flu. But those numbers are likely to go significantly down as we find more cases, because I suspect that there are many thousands, tens of thousands of cases out there that we haven't picked up that are mild or asymptomatic. And so I think the death rate will go down. But bottom line, it's highly infectious. People will die, and there'll be a lot of hospitalizations and a run on our hospitals. You know, what we don't know is, you know, what is the animal vector? Where did this come from? We think it was a bat and some kind of an intermediary vector. We also don't know exactly how it spreads in households, nursing homes, prisons, things like that, but we know it seems to be spreading quite rapidly. We don't know exactly the death rate, as I've explained, and we don't have a vaccine. We hope to have one in a little while, and we don't have a specific treatment.
How good are we at the moment at testing?
Well, you know, the United States is not, you know, reflected well on itself. There's been much better, more accurate and more widespread testing in Japan, China, South Korea, and other countries, Italy. So originally, all tests had to go through the CDC lab in Atlanta, and that took up to a week to get back. That was unacceptable. Then the CDC sent lab kits out to the states, but they were faulty. They had quality problems. And now CDC has expanded the number of people who should be tested, which is a very good thing. And they've made available a lot more test kits. So I think we're going to be seeing testing rolling out. But we missed critical days, because in a fast-moving epidemic, you know, days matter, and we probably missed days or weeks.
Are test kits, do they necessarily come from the CDC, or can they now be developed elsewhere?
Well, the CDC, you know, the FDA is given authority for, you know, state and other health labs now to start doing the results. But people are going to have to buy the test kits. We had a shortage, but we seem to be ramping up right now. You know, the federal government seems to be in charge of supplying hospitals and state and local health departments with test kits at the moment.
Would you call this an epidemic, or has it reached the point of pandemic?
Well, you know, it's a good question. In a way, it doesn't matter. It's certainly an epidemic, and I believe we're actually past the stage where we might call it a pandemic. The World Health Organization has said, and I'm willing to accept that, that it's we're on the precipice of a pandemic. But in a way, you know, it's a word, and it's a frightening word. It almost has panic written within the term pandemic. But all it, you know, there, it's a subjective definition. It all it means is that there's sustained worldwide spread. And that seems to be the case now, or will soon be.
You mentioned nursing homes, prisons, and I'm sure you include hospitals as well as places where it might get spread. For people who aren't in institutions of that kind, what should they do?
Well, you know, what they should do is, first of all, abide by common sense personal hygiene. That is, cover your sneezes and coughs, wash your hands often, don't touch your eyes or nose or your mouth anywhere on your face. I would even say, you know, try to avoid shaking hands with people. And if you're sick, stay home, or if you need to see a doctor, but don't go to school or to work, and stay away from people who have symptoms. Just common, and then probably disinfecting surfaces, because this is a virus that really is in large droplets. It will land on something, somebody will touch it, then they'll put it to their face, and then the virus will get embedded in their own body.
You mentioned symptoms. What are they?
They're basically the same as flu, flu-like symptoms, you know, fever, cough, cold, probably in the more serious cases, respiratory problems, you know, difficulty breathing, things like that. I'm feeling generally unwell. I mean, I always kind of laugh at my friends who say, I have a touch of the flu. No, you don't have a touch of the flu. If you've got true influenza, you can barely move. So you kind of know you have it. And the coronavirus is not quite the same in that there's a broad spectrum of symptoms from the very, very serious and life-threatening through to the asymptomatic and mild. Most people will get mild symptoms, but people who are most vulnerable are those who are elderly or those who have what we call comorbidities. So, for example, if you've got asthma, heart disease, diabetes, if you're obese because you may have breathing problems, things like that. Those are the ones that we need, that are the most vulnerable, and we need to pay most attention to.
When you say you can't have a touch of the flu, it suggests that the symptoms have to be pretty grave before you have to really take seriously the prospect that it might be COVID-19.
Well, you know, as we get more transmission in the United States, more and more people are probably going to have COVID-19. Now, for many people, they'll just, they should stay at home, work on their own symptoms, take cough medicine or whatever they, or ibuprofen, just to kind of keep comfortable. For most people, that'll be all right. But for others, it'll get worse. They'll have trouble breathing. They'll feel extraordinarily unwell. And in those cases, you need to seek medical attention quite quickly. And then if you do seek medical attention, they will test you for COVID-19.
What about going to places where large numbers of people gather, whether it's conferences or theaters or even, big grocery stores or commercial complexes?
Yeah, I get that question all the time, and it's a fine balance, obviously those are the places where you're more likely to be infected, but, we need to live our ordinary daily lives. Can you imagine if the effect on social life and also the effect on our economy, if people stopped going to restaurants, movie theaters, sporting events, and of course, you have to go to the grocery store in order to eat. This could be, very socially disruptive. So right now, I would suggest to people, be careful, use your common sense, but it's okay to go out. Don't panic. There may come a time, and may come within weeks, we don't know, where we'll move to what we call mitigation measures or social distancing. Things like temporary school closures or telecommuting to office or to school, where, big congregate events will be postponed. I could foresee that happening in the United States. We're not there yet, and I think it would be unwise for us to just succumb to the virus and get scared. We need to live our normal lives, just be sensible.
Well, there are places where it is happening. There are conferences that have been canceled. There are various things. And so is that premature?
Well, it's a judgment call. I mean, if the conference can be postponed, and it's not entirely necessary, yeah, I mean, that's fine. I just don't. So if a business leader like, you know, Facebook, Microsoft, whatever it might be, decide to, well, let's not host our big annual conference this year. And that seems to me to make sense, unless it was essential. What I'm talking about is, everyday people, you know, your lives, you know, going out to movies, you know, going to work, going to school, going to the grocery store. I think it's premature for us to kind of self-isolate unless we're ill, of course.
You talked about mitigation and social distancing. Does the government have the authority to enforce that?
Yes. I mean, so for example, this would be at a state and local level rather than the federal level. Like a school board could temporarily close the schools, of course. If the health department felt that there was a significant risk of a big major convention or something, they could ban it on public health grounds. Yeah, so there are powers. They're called police powers, but they're just basically, you know, state and local governments have the power to safeguard the population, and they can take measures as long as, and I have to stress this, as long as they're, number one, science-based and evidence-based, number two, proportionate and reasonable, and number three, the least restrictive alternative, so that we're not needlessly violating people's civil and human rights.
Okay, a lot of different kinds of decisions then, it seems to me, would have to be made. Let me ask you another kind of question. If you get tested, or if you are, in fact, quarantined for some period of time, who should pay the freight?
Yeah, I mean, if the government quarantines you or medically isolates you, I have a very, very strong view that it's the government's responsibility to assume responsibility for your care, your essential needs in humane, medically appropriate conditions, and you should not have to pay. I mean, if you think about it from an ethics point of view, if the government is requiring you to do something, you shouldn't have to pay to have that happen. So it's a social contract. You know, in your restricting your liberty for the benefit of the common good, the public. And in exchange, we agree to take very good care of you and not to charge you.
What about testing? If, in fact, you do that with the public interest in mind, as well as just for yourself, should you be paid for that?
Well, I've recommended and my colleagues have recommended that we should waive fees for doctor's visits and testing and other things related to the coronavirus. And the reason for that is not only for the ethics, but, you know, otherwise people won't come in for testing if they're afraid about the cost. And that's the last thing we want.
We're talking with Lawrence Gostin. He's advisor to the World Health Organization on epidemics and pandemics. In a moment, some history. First, a short break on To the Point.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Well, I'll be back with To the Point. Professor Gostin, tell us about epidemics and how they have shaped societies in the past.
Well, you know, epidemics have had enormous implications for societies, and it goes back to pre-biblical times with leprosy. But every major epidemic has really changed the fabric of society. The most recent, of course, was the great influenza pandemic in 1918. It swept around the world. One third of humanity was infected, and it killed a very substantial number of the world's population at the time. At the same time, you know, cities closed down. There was panic, fear, and so you have all kinds of social things, or even something that's, you know, not as quite as dramatic, but equally impactful. We tend to scapegoat. You know, right now, you know, I worry about Chinese Americans or people of Asian descent being discriminated against or stereotyped. And, you know, so we always, during epidemics, it often brings out the worst in us. You know, we label and blame the other. We call them dirty or unclean. And it has it can have a very corrosive effect on society. That's why I believe right now we all need to come together as a national and global community, pull together, look after one another, and sacrifice a little bit of our individuality for the common good.
It's great to hear you say that, but there already are examples of two things going on, it seems to me. On the one hand, scare tactics. On the other, a downplaying of the importance and potential danger of what we're talking about. Are there examples of where it has been handled in such a way that it has brought people together, that it has had the kind of consequence that you would hope for?
Well, you know, it's hard. Culture means a lot, you know, and the United States is very individualistic, whereas many Asian cultures are much more socially embedded. You know, they look after one another. China is a particularly hard case because I did not like at all the kind of intrusive, you know, mass quarantine of 50 million people using your cell phones to track you and so forth. But it has caused some social anger in China, and I think is a risk to Xi Jinping, the head of the president of China. Having said that, you know, so many Chinese will say, okay, well, you know, this has been a sacrifice, but we need to do it for the public good. And I, you know, you see that in other Asian cultures as well. You know, I've been saying for a long time in the United States, you know, we used to have a spirit of, you know, commonality. If you think back to the, you know, Franklin Delano Roosevelt's Great New Deal, his war on poverty, and then with Lyndon Johnson, John Kennedy saying, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. We used to have that, but we've kind of lost it, and we need to recapture that. And this is the perfect moment for us to set aside our differences and come together as a nation.
So there is a way, then, of looking at this, I wouldn't say in exactly a positive way, but suggesting that something positive might come out of it.
Well, yes, I hope so. You know, something positive might come out of it. I mean, we're in a very corrosive political and social environment. We don't trust one another in the United States. And you know, when we're hit by an invisible but common enemy, a germ, I think it behooves us all to kind of pull together and stop, you know, name-calling, blaming the other, and just seeing what we can do as families, as neighbors, as community members, and as citizens to look after one another. I was just tweeting today saying, think about, you know, visiting a vulnerable or elderly friend or neighbor during this. See how they are. See if they're ill. See if they need any food or medicine, or just if they're lonely. Sit down and talk to them. That would be lovely if America responded in that wonderful way.
Is this an opportunity for political leaders whether it's President Trump or anybody else, to play a role in trying to deal with this in such a way that it's as undisruptive as possible.
Yes, I mean, I think the president is an extraordinarily important figure. If you go back again to FDR with his fireside chats, the president needs to be trusted. We need to be able to believe that he's telling us the truth and he's telling us the whole truth, and that he's a national pastor, somebody that is a spiritual leader, but also taking firm charge of the epidemic. We do have to look for leadership at this time.
I can't help but ask you, do you think he's done a good job so far?
Well, I'm trying to give him the benefit of the doubt, even though I have major worries and criticisms. I think the messaging has been poor in terms of trying to, downplay this as if it's a cold or the flu. I also think that, when Vice President Pence told the public health officials to clear information and messaging through the White House, it seems to me that he got it exactly backwards. It's the political leaders who should clear messaging with the public health and scientists. So those are really concerns of mine. Having said that, I think that the task force he's assembled, including people from NIH, Tony Fauci, CDC, Ann Schadet, Deborah Birx, who's all of those people are world-class public health people. He's got, if our political bodies listen and let the public health people pretty much run the show, we'll be in good hands. I think that CDC is the best public health agency in the world. Our state and local health departments are really extraordinary, but they need economic support and they need political support, and they need it now.
I know that you're going to be advising Facebook as well as other institutions that have a vast audience. What are you going to tell them?
I think people should not get their information through random tweets or Facebook posts. They should get their information from a single trusted public health source. I think if Facebook or others really guided people toward reliable information, I would say that those would be CDC's website, World Health Organization's website, state and local health departments where you live. Those are the best and most trusted sources of information, and most people should be going there.
And they have information now that is sufficiently comprehensive that people can really learn something and get some guidance as to what to do.
Yeah, I mean, I was just, going through the CDC's website today on COVID-19. It's extraordinarily thorough.
Okay, and what about plans for travel over the summer?
I'm slated to go to the World Health Organization, but I've just heard today that the World Health Assembly is going to take place, and so I'm planning to travel.
And where's that?
To Geneva.
Lawrence Gostin, I know that you are an extraordinarily busy person, very much in demand at the moment as we speak, and that you will be for a long time to come. You're very kind to have taken the time to join us today, and thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Warren, and you've done a great public service. Thank you.
Today's podcast was produced by Andrea Brody. Our engineer is Chuck Previtary. I'm Warren Olney. You can hear past episodes of To the Point wherever you get your podcasts. We'd very much like to hear from you on Twitter at @ToThePoint_KCRW. I'm @WarrenOlney1. Tell us what you think we need to know and join us again.